It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Ainsley Earhart.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Katie Pavlich, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, December 8th, 2022. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. The 2022 midterms are officially in the books with the results of the Georgia Senate runoff. And now the analysts, strategists, and politicos begin the deep dives into the data to find out how to win in 2024.
I think the takeaway point from the last 10 or 15 years of American politics is that if you want to be in the White House, you need to go now.
The Democratic strategy may be more of the same.
Joe Biden is in really good position, and as long as he has a clean bill of health, I don't know what Democrat in their right mind would want him not to run in 2024.
I'm Dave Anthony. Colorado's anti-discrimination law is being challenged again at the Supreme Court, again over religious objections to same-sex weddings.
What's at stake is free speech for everyone. No one should be forced to have to create a custom message or to say something that violates their beliefs.
And I'm Greg Jarrett. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
We knew the balance of power was not at stake heading into Tuesday's Senate runoff in Georgia. Democrats had already won 50 Senate seats in November. But still, there was talk of more breathing room should the incumbent Democrat, Raphael Warnock, win and keep the seat. It was a relief when he did to the man who keeps his title, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
51, a slim majority. That is great. And we are so happy about it.
The Republican Senate candidate, Georgia football star Herschel Walker, gave a concession speech Tuesday night.
I want you to believe in America and continue to believe in the Constitution and believe in our elected officials most of all. Continue to pray for them because all the prayers you've given me, I felt those prayers.
The race was called relatively early. The only outstanding counties after a couple of hours were considered more reliably blue: Fulton, Cobb, DeKalb. And Warnock told his supporters the people had spoken.
I'm proud of the bipartisan work I've done, and I intend to do more because I actually believe that at the end of the day, we are all Americans. I believe in that American covenant.
The data will be crunched now in Georgia and all counties, but especially those in swing states, purple states, even those with more blue or red hues, to find out how voters in the suburbs felt. In Georgia, did black men shift toward Republicans more or stay home? And how will voters feel about the next wave of candidates after the wins and losses of the midterms? For now in Georgia, while Republicans won state races, they lost this Senate seat again.
From a governance perspective, moving from 50-50 with Vice President Harris breaking ties in the Senate to 51-49, where she's not obligated to do that, creates a situation where players like Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, exercise less discretion.
Darren Shaw is a University of Texas at Austin professor and a member of the Fox News Decision Desk.
Where the ratio of Democratic dominance on Senate committees is altered in a favorable way, where the agendas and the power of people like McConnell versus Schumer are affected, all of that stuff. You wouldn't think moving from a functional majority to a true majority really matters, but it really does. It's consequential at that level for all of Biden's judicial nominees, for the Democrats' ability to continue to use subpoena power in the Senate to kind of create problems for the Republicans and for Trump and, you know, Trump personnel from the previous administration. All of that is affected by this race. On the electoral side, it is another defeat for a Donald Trump endorsed candidate in the 2022 midterms. It reinforces the notion that, you know, the Republicans have some structural problems with respect to identifying candidates, getting them through the primaries, raising money, and competing in some of these battleground states with the Democrats.
This midterm cycle had been marked by a lot of talk about candidate quality. And as you know, Mr. Walker, for all the talk about what a flawed candidate he was, do Republicans say, hey, even with that, he didn't lose by that much? It was about 3 points. If we ran a stronger candidate in Georgia, that seat probably would have gone our way. Or do they say, wow, you know, Georgia's changing, ticket splitting is real here. What do they do with this information looking ahead?
I think the lessons from Georgia and Arizona are reasonably consistent and reasonably clear. And that is that in states where the balance of power is very, very thin, where the Republicans still probably have a functional majority on the order of 2 to 3 points, you cannot nominate suboptimal candidates in those positions. They've managed to lose the top of the ticket races in these states consistently by nominating flawed candidates. Now, the exception is Kemp. You don't have to be a political methodologist to take a look at the difference between the Kemp vote and the Walker vote and say, gee, that seems to be the difference between a good Republican candidate and a bad Republican candidate in Georgia, right? I think that's kind of reasonable. Is it the case that there are demographic changes in those states that are favorable to the Democrats? Yeah, I mean, that's completely fair. But the Republicans won the state house votes in both states. They won other statewide races in both Arizona and in Georgia. So while it's true that, those states are changing, you got to really look at the way Republicans are identifying and supporting these candidates at the top of the ticket. It's just kind of killing them in those states, and it's really killing the party nationally.
So, Darren, we have to ask, okay, now it's all over, right? It's officially over. Georgia, the final thing was the Georgia Senate runoff. Now we can really, move into that 2024 mindset. What are your thoughts for either side, for both sides? What's sort of hanging out there that you would say, these are the things that both parties are really going to be paying attention to, or these are the lessons learned from 2022. This is the vibe.
The attention span of the American public is so short. The time at which you are a hot candidate, that you are a celebrity, that you are seen as something new and different, the turnaround is increasingly quick. So when Barack Obama ran in 2008, you probably remember this. People say, like, boy, he doesn't have any experience. He's such a newbie. People said the same thing about Ted Cruz. But I think you strike while the iron is hot. And so the kinds of people on the Republican side that we're talking about as credible candidates now, whether it's Youngkin or DeSantis, I think the takeaway point from the last 10 or 15 years of American politics is that if you want to be in the White House, you need to go now. Not wait till 2028 or, till a real post-Trump era, but go. And if that's what they're thinking, and my guess is it probably is, then the question becomes, have Republican voters moved on Trump? Is he seen as yesterday's news? Is the same kind of celebrity and star power that powered his drive in 2016, is it still there? And 2022 did deliver some powerful information about that, right? That with respect to the electorate writ large, his appeal amongst Democrats is zero and his appeal amongst independents seems to be diminishing. Do Republicans take that into account and update their preferences accordingly?
For Democrats, they move into the next election cycle with a House in Republican hands, but not by as wide a margin as predicted. The Senate not only remains in Democrats' hands, they picked up a seat. And as Fox News co-host of The Five and Democratic strategist Jessica Tarlov notes, they still have the White House.
Well, I'm hearing a lot about how historic it is, which it is, how amazing of a candidate he is, and that's not being talked about enough. A lot of it was focused on how bad of a candidate Herschel Walker was, and that's absolutely true. And I think it's really interesting as well. I don't know if you caught Herschel's concession speech, but it was actually the best he'd ever sounded on the campaign trail. And I thought to myself, oh, he probably could have picked up a few more Kemp voters who decided to sit this out if he had sounded this way all along. But Raphael Warnock ran a really disciplined, a really on-message campaign. So they sent back Brian Kemp, Raffensperger, Gabe Sterling, et cetera. This is not a liberal state. This is definitely purple. And I get it that it's trending blue in a lot of ways now that we have two Democratic senators there. But people are kind of losing sight of what a feat it is for a Democrat to win statewide and by 100,000 votes.
To your point, you're talking about that Warnock was as good of a candidate as maybe Walker was not as good of a candidate.
Yeah.
But when you do the cross references, right, when you compare Warnock to Stacey Abrams and then Kemp to Walker, I mean, what should Democrats take away from this, if anything? I understand it's celebratory right now, but what's the deeper dive when we move into 2024?
That every vote matters. That specific messaging for particular groups is important. That making sure that you're courting the black male vote specifically and not just treating black voters as a monolith, and frankly, just not getting caught up in whatever today's media cycle is. And I think that's true for all campaigns. If you look at what Mark Kelly did in Arizona as well, he ran a disciplined campaign where the daily grind of, you know, whatever we're talking about on cable news was not what he was talking about. He wanted to talk about the issues that mattered to voters every single day. And that's also why he was talking about the border, something that he knows full well matters to Arizonans.
To the lesson point, for all the talk that Democrats are actually pretty happy right now, right?
Yeah.
They didn't lose the House by much. The Senate, they held. You know, still not too long ago, right? You look at Virginia, you look at Governor Youngkin, you look again, as we talk about candidate quality mattering, you know, when you look at the overall lesson and you start to look at other states and other recent moments, you know, maybe just right before the midterms, and I'm talking about Governor Youngkin, you know, how do you factor in that to the lesson when we talk about candidates mattering again as we move into 2024?
That it's true for both sides of the aisle, I guess, is the big lesson from it. And that every cycle is going to also have outlier events. There can be these black swan events, right? And Virginia is not a red state now because of what Glenn Youngkin was able to pull off. But there is a mold that people can learn from and that they can follow. And I think you see that as well with someone like Jared Polis, who's the recently reelected governor of Colorado, who basically governs as a libertarian. He supports some bills, has put some bills forward that you would think would come from a Republican's desk. But he's also, you know, amazing on all the issues that are top priorities for Democrats. And looking at candidates like those and taking lessons from them is something that I think is critically important.
And finally, Jess, every conversation we always have, it's like 2024. Right?
Yeah,
I know it's always too early. But the line that I keep hearing from some conservatives is, well, the night wasn't so bad for Democrats, right, in November. And obviously,
no, it was good.
So, right. So the red wave didn't happen. So now President Biden has to run again. And I guess some people on the right are actually happy about that. Do you see it that way? Does he have to run again? Does he see it that way? If you know,
well, he wants to, and I want him to, and everybody who likes winning should want him to. I would, and I've never done this before, I would direct all of our listeners to Newt Gingrich's column from the weekend that was entitled "Stop Underestimating Joe Biden." He's lapping people. Everything that he said on the campaign trail that he could do that was special, he has done. He can work across the aisle. We have gun reform. We have bipartisan infrastructure. We've had the most successful midterms since 1934. I think it was, where we didn't lose a single Senate seat and even picked one up for the first midterm of a new president. This man does not get the level of credit that he deserves for this. And we also had great candidates, and I don't want to diminish any of that. But I know the infighting is fun, and we all need our clicks and we need our hits and, you know, all the viewers. Keep watching The Five. It's the best. But Joe Biden is in really good position, and as long as he has a clean bill of health, I don't know what Democrat in their right mind would want him not to run in 2024.
Jessica Tarlov, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is Greg Jarrett with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The Supreme Court heard another religious freedom case this week that for the second time challenges an anti-discrimination law in Colorado. It involves Lori Smith, a web designer who cites her Christian faith, believing she has the right to not make wedding websites for same-sex couples. At Monday's hearing, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, considered to be among the conservative-leaning court's liberal minority, wondered if this is the first time the court could rule
a commercial business open to the public, serving the public, that it could refuse to serve a customer based on race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation, correct?
Yes.
That yes came from Colorado's Solicitor General, Eric Olson, who argued
the company just cannot refuse to serve gay couples, as it seeks to do here, just as the Christmas store cannot announce no Jews allowed.
Attorney Kristen Wagner argued the other side before the justices.
What's at stake is free speech for everyone. No one should be forced to have to create a custom message or to say something that violates their beliefs.
Wagner is CEO, president, and general counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom.
It doesn't matter what that belief is on a particular issue. What matters is that it's not the government's role to tell Americans what they can and can't say and to threaten them with punishment if they don't agree with the government's views.
And so this is all stemming from Colorado's anti-discrimination law. What is the issue here? You were arguing in favor for Lori Smith, right? She's a graphic artist and a website designer in Colorado. What is her issue?
Well, Lori blends art with technology to create custom messages. And she uses custom words, graphics, videos, all kinds of pictures, as well as obviously text, to imagine and to design and then create a message. Usually she's celebrating or promoting something in a wide variety of areas, but this case focused on her desire to create custom one-of-a-kind websites to celebrate her faith's view of marriage. So wedding websites for couples to celebrate their upcoming weddings. And her faith teaches her that marriage is between a man and a woman. So while she serves everyone, including her LGBT clients, on the issue of marriage, she can't design a custom website that celebrates a view of marriage she believes to be false. And so that's what the case was about, is Colorado is telling her that she has to create custom messages and websites that promote a view of marriage that simply violates her conscience.
Okay. You said Colorado forces her. Has someone come to her and asked her specifically to create a website for a same-sex wedding as a customer at this point? Has that happened to her?
She has had requests for wedding websites, but the whole point of this law is that a person doesn't have to wait to go into business to violate a law in order to challenge it. You don't have to wait to face civil penalties or jail time to say that this law violates the Constitution.
Now, if all this sounds familiar, it's because 5 years ago, Colorado's anti-discrimination law was also before the Supreme Court, and Kristen Wagner argued that case, too, on behalf of a baker, Jack Phillips, who refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple. The court ruled narrowly in his favor, not on the wider challenge to the law, but the Colorado's Civil Rights Commission acted with anti-religious bias, enforcing the law against Phillips.
There were essentially two claims. One was a violation of his religious freedom. We'd call that free exercise of religion. And the second was that it was a violation of his free speech rights. In Colorado, the commission that initially decided Jack's case was so hostile to his faith that in proceedings, these commissioners compared his faith to those who perpetrated the Holocaust and to slave owners, saying that it was essentially despicable beliefs, and that the court said that that kind of impermissible hostility was a violation of the First Amendment in and of itself. So it didn't even reach the free speech argument because it didn't need to. Lori's case is focused exclusively on the free speech question. And her case also has facts that are agreed to by Colorado, which makes this case a little bit unique in terms of having both parties say, yes, we agree she's actually creating custom speech. And Colorado's also agreed that her message is what dictates her decisions.
Okay. Now, I know on the other side, Colorado is arguing that it's essentially what you're asking for is a license to discriminate. That's what they're sort of saying, essentially, that it would allow her to discriminate against same-sex couples by allowing her to make wedding websites for those who seek a traditional marriage. That's the argument. Why, in your view, are they wrong?
You can't force people to say things they don't believe. And these laws, the way that Colorado's trying to use this law, it would compel the LGBT graphic designer to have to express views that violate her conscience about sexuality or marriage. A lot of these laws apply to political belief. Under Colorado's theory, a Democrat publicist could be forced to write a press release for a Republican. You could have a Hindu forced to do a film that promotes Scientology. It's not the government's role to punish and ruin people for simply trying to speak and live consistent with their beliefs. And we should all be concerned, regardless of what our political affiliation is, when we give the government that kind of power.
There have been hypotheticals that were thrown at you at the court by justices in particular. What if someone were to refuse to make a website, or in this, you know, to be more specific toward what she does for a living, against an interracial couple that wants to get married? These are the kinds of hypotheticals. What was your response to that?
If you are turning someone away because of who they are, not based on the message that you're being asked to create, that violates the law, and it will still violate the law regardless of whether Lori wins in this case. Lori serves everyone, as all people should, but she doesn't create all messages, and we all want to have the freedom to not have to say things that violate our convictions.
I'll give you another hypothetical. What if someone in Colorado wanted to, was in business, and Planned Parenthood came and wanted something, a website built, but you are a devout Christian and you're pro-life and you cannot deal with someone who is an abortion provider? What would happen in that case?
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because under Colorado's theory, not only could a pro-life printer who's designing a custom invitation or designing a custom brochure be compelled to promote a pro-abortion message, but a pro-abortion photographer could be forced to photograph and promote a pro-life rally. And the First Amendment prevents that, but that's what Colorado's arguing before in this case.
She is arguing on behalf of her religious beliefs. Is that essential in an argument against the Colorado anti-discrimination law, that someone's religious beliefs have to be at issue?
No, but it's good that you raised the point, because it also, under Colorado's theory, would force an atheist soloist to have to perform at a religious service. We can think of all the different categories where certain individuals will not want to promote certain messages, whether those messages are religious that they don't want to promote, or whether it's a religious person that doesn't want to promote another faith. Colorado's theory says you can compel that kind of speech. And again, that's what makes it an existential threat to freedom. And I think it's important to realize that we're talking about the government silencing and suppressing speech. And we see that in other parts of the world, what that leads to, that kind of authoritarianism. It's one thing to say that the answer is more speech and private individuals can respond. It's another to threaten jail time for those who don't agree with the government. And there are right now cases pending where photographers are facing jail time for declining to create custom photographs of weddings that they disagree with.
When the liberal justices brought up business owners who might want to not serve, say, a black customer or a disabled customer, that's different to you than what you're arguing in this case?
It's not just different to me. It's illegal. And it's that case, that's not even before this case. I think that shows the limits or the lengths to which the other side has to go. Rather than engaging with what this case is about, they have to provide hypotheticals that aren't even impacted. So first of all, the law is very clear. If you're declining to serve someone because of who they are, that's illegal. You can't turn people away because they are in a protected class. You simply can't do that.
Well, someone who is in the LGBT community might say, well, that is who I am when I want to have her build me a wedding website. So she's discriminating against me because of who I am.
Well, they can certainly say that, but I think that what the law has looked at is, first of all, is this speech? Are you asking someone to use their heart, their head, and their hand to create a message? Justice Gorsuch said it very well, and another number of justices echoed it. The critical distinction in this case is that Lori serves everyone, including the LGBT, those who identify as LGBT, but she doesn't create all messages. And it doesn't matter who asks for that message. It could be someone who's heterosexual. It could be on another subject altogether. And she would decline that message if it's not consistent with her faith. Lastly, I just want to make sure it's clear. We're talking about custom speech, meaning that it's something you're asking someone to create expressly with a message that's objectionable to them. This isn't something that's pre-made, sitting on the shelf, ready to go, you know, or a plug and play website. It is custom, and that makes all the difference under the First Amendment.
What did you think? People love to read tea leaves after justices ask questions in these kinds of hearings and say, well, it looks like we're going to win or we're going to lose. Did you have any feeling when you left the courtroom?
The Supreme Court has never compelled ideological, political, or religious speech. It would be unprecedented for them to compel speech. So in that way, I am optimistic that the court recognizes the principle at stake, which is that the government does not have the power to tell Americans what to say and to use the power of law and such draconian punishments to censor views that the government dislikes. It's not about marriage. It's about all kinds of speech, and we need to protect it.
Kristen Wagoner, CEO, President, General Counsel of Alliance Defending Freedom, who argued the case before the Supreme Court on Monday. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Meet the American who
was the first paid professional football player.
William Walter Pudge Heffelfinger was born in Minneapolis in 1867. A Paul Bunyan-esque behemoth, Pudge was tall, strapping, handsome, and ferocious. He was 6 foot, 3 inches tall and 205 pounds, and a star of the Yale football team from 1888 to 1891. The 1888 Yale team actually went 13-0, outscoring its opponents 698-0. After his time at Yale, Heffelfinger was paid $500 to play in a game for the Pittsburgh area Allegheny Athletic Association on November 12, 1892. In that moment, Heffelfinger likely entered history as the first pro football player. Sports historian Ken Crippen told Fox News Digital, other players may have been paid to play before him, but we don't know for sure. But a club invoice confirms Pudge was indeed paid to play football. Crippen said Heffelfinger was the first for whom we have proof, and after him, you started to see a shift towards teams openly playing players in order to get the best players. While Heffelfinger made $500 for a game in 1892, by contrast, Aaron Rodgers, today's highest paid pro football player, makes $2.9 million per game. Heffelfinger served as a football mercenary for most of his life, playing his last game for charity at the age of 64. He was the most amazing football player I had ever known, said famed sports writer Grantlin Rice. I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section of FoxNews.com for more of these incredible American stories.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Subscribe to this podcast at FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Greg Jarrett.
What's on your mind?
Just weeks before the presidential contest in 2020, the surfacing of Hunter Biden's laptop posed a mortal threat to Joe Biden's chances of getting elected. Incriminating emails contained therein offered compelling evidence that the father was complicit in his son's elaborate influence peddling schemes involving nefarious foreign actors paying millions of dollars for access and promises of favor. So the Biden campaign team and Democratic operatives, with a big assist from partisans at the FBI, applied pressure on the social media giant Twitter to block the story. The predominantly liberal staff of the tech company happily capitulated. They invented a farcical pretext that the laptop was hacked, strictly forbid any mention of it on their site, suspended the account of the New York Post that had broken the story, and punished anyone who dared share it by banishing them from Twitter. These actions constitute unwarranted censorship at its ugliest. Elon Musk, the new owner of Twitter, has now wisely resolved to pull back the veil of secrecy by releasing the so-called Twitter files. They expose the machinations of those who suppressed the story at the behest and request of others. Musk should be commended for his effort at transparency to rebuild public trust. The Twitter docs offer a damning indictment of how top executives at the company slanted content moderation decisions to favor and protect Joe Biden to the disadvantage of his political opponent. Communications show that Twitter acted on a variety of censorship demands by Biden's presidential campaign. There was no credible evidence the laptop was hacked, Russian involvement was non-existent, and the new files prove that Twitter officials knew it. And in fact, they voiced concerns internally. Yet they clung to that phony excuse in part because the company's deputy general counsel, James Baker, urged them to do so. The FBI's role in burying the details of the laptop is verified in a declaration signed by Twitter's former head of site integrity, Yul Roth. It's also confirmed by FBI supervisory agent Elvis Chan during his testimony in a censorship lawsuit. Chan is the one who organized the secret meetings with both Twitter and Facebook to spike the story. It's a violation of the First Amendment for the government to engage in censorship, either overtly or covertly. And while a publicly held or privately held company is under no such constraints, the government is. And that includes the FBI manipulating or coercing companies to behave as proxies to accomplish prohibited censorship. It's common for political campaigns to lobby journalists and social media for favorable coverage. But if these censorship demands continued into the new administration when Joe Biden took office, as the Twitter communications indicate, this would be a violation of the First Amendment. Congress has a duty to investigate whether the president and his acolytes shredded the Constitution for political gain. I'm Greg Jarrett for Fox News Radio.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.